Well, I mean, because here's the thing. How much do we want to talk about the impeachment thing?
I've not read a goddamn thing about it.
Well, I feel like if we want to just do it in the intro, that's all I have. Like, I have
no, it's not going to be part of the show, but I do think that it is news. So if we are going to talk about it, we can talk about it in the intro. I don't have a ton to say about it, except to just like, let us just note where we are now, that we are just in, if the House is owned by the other party that is not the presidency, we're just going to impeach presidents forever until it becomes until it becomes something that is politically not, you know, positive. But right now,
I've got for a macro thought.
Okay, go.
I've got a macro thought on all this that I can wax poetic about. I think this is going to sound weird. It's kind of unformed. I think part of the angst that we're experiencing as a people right now is that we're living in a period kind of similar to right before World War I, where like the old institutions are dying, but they're still there. So like you have like these two zombie parties that nobody fucking likes that still have immense power within the country. No one likes them. A third of the people have dropped. We've talked about this a tremendous amount, right? The old institutions, we've talked about how media in the United States, the press has declined in terms of public trust. Government has declined in terms of public trust. I'm increasingly of the opinion that we're living at the tail end of an epoch, and there's something else that's going to come, but the reforms haven't happened yet. And so you have a people that are effectively untethered from the institutions that they're participating in. And the institutions are kind of on their last legs and a bit ossified. And so I think you're going to see more of this kind of stuff where the norms have eroded and just sort of political based impeachments, I think, will become very common. And I think we're beginning to see this. And it wouldn't surprise me at all if just every president gets impeached, or at least they try to impeach them moving forward.
Well, I think they will all be impeached, because you don't start an impeachment unless you are going to finish it. It has been compared to skydiving. Both Nancy Pelosi and now Kevin McCarthy have tried to pull the little wiggle room, because the impeachments are not particularly thrilling to the American public. But they say, oh, we're just starting an impeachment inquiry, which is like saying, I'm just starting to skydive. Like, you're going to get to the bottom no matter what, because the political opposite of that would be beginning an impeachment inquiry and then finding your political opponent not impeachable, which is not going
turns
to be something.
Turns out he's a great guy.
Yeah.
I'm glad we looked into this. He's a solid dude.
I do think that we should acknowledge like the starting line they're actually at, though, because at this point we just have Kevin McCarthy saying like, we're having an impeachment inquiry, and refers three committees that are already investigating Biden to investigate Biden. And they seem to be wanting the impeachment inquiry to give them more power to issue subpoenas. But the Justice Department has already ruled that unless the House has voted on an impeachment inquiry, this isn't really a thing.
And so they did that
unclear.
When Pelosi did it for Ukraine. So eventually they're going to do a vote, and they're going to, I mean, essentially this is
same. Part isn't clear if they are having, at this moment, it's just an announcement that these investigations are essentially going to continue as they are. They're just calling it an impeachment inquiry. Until that vote happens, there's no extra power. It sounds like it's news, but it's not really, because nothing really changes with this announcement.
Well, but then Pelosi's announcement wasn't news, which it was. So it's about as much news as
Pelosi had a vote.
No, she didn't.
There was a vote to do that impeachment inquiry.
Eventually there was a vote, but she launched it without one. And Kevin McCarthy and Jim Jordan criticized her for it. And now they're doing the exact same thing. So I think it's going to follow the exact same path that the Ukraine impeachment did, that Pelosi did. In fact, Kevin McCarthy is saying that he is doing this because he is following the precedent that was set by Pelosi during the Ukraine impeachment.
Which is fine. But the Ukraine impeachment inquiry was different because there was subpoena power. Right now, there isn't any. So it's just like looking at it as someone who watches how Congress operates.
Yeah.
Nothing has changed with this announcement until there's a vote. So I think that matters.
Well, it matters that you are now throwing yourself out of the plane. So everything else that's going to happen on the way down becomes fait accompli. And you are just putting political pressure on the Biden district Republicans that are now going to be strong armed into voting for this where they initially didn't, which is why this is even a question, because Kevin McCarthy is getting dragged by his right flank, who, by the way, are still not happy. And Matt Gaetz has said he's going to begin every House session with a prayer, the pledge, and a motion to vacate. He has tried to recruit Democrats for it. And, you know, that is that. The one thing that I did want to bring up is something that I put in our group chat, which I found particularly enraging this morning. And that was a letter sent by the White House to CNN, the New York Times, Fox News, the Associated Press, CBS News, and others that called for the media to ramp up its scrutiny of House Republicans for opening an impeachment inquiry based on lies. This is the thing that really annoyed me. Quote, covering impeachment as a process story, Republicans say X, but the White House says Y, is a disservice to the American public who relies on the independent press to hold those in power accountable. And in the modern media environment where everyday liars and hucksters peddle disinformation and lies everywhere from Facebook to Fox, process stories that fail to unpack the illegitimacy of the claims in which the House Republicans are basing all their actions on only serve to generate confusion, put false premises in people's feeds, and obscure the truth, which I found infuriating because it is not making their case. It is not them saying, here are the facts as we see them, and we are refuting what is being said by the Republicans. They are telling the press that you are actively poisoning the public unless you write these stories as PR for us, because we are the arbiters of truth. And I'm always on the side of journalists. This in another world, this would be something that would be looked at as really gross. And I just want to be on the side of saying it's really gross.
Well, and it's going to backfire. Like, you're basically telling the media that you want them to focus on this more. Like, okay, good idea, guys. Like, I don't think this is going to work out well for them.
Yeah, I don't see a lot of gains coming from that. As you rightly point out, Justin, the political authorities saying you have to adopt our political message or you're hurting the body politic is not a very good message to send to an independent press like that. That is there are some basic logical problems there. One would assume that conservative media will make hay out of that.
Yeah.
And that progressive media was already going to do the thing they were going to tell them to do. So I guess like center left media could theoretically be swayed by this, but it's not going to move the needle very much, and it's going to give a lot of ammunition to the conservatives in the meantime. So I don't know what they meant to accomplish with it.
Also, did they need more of a lifeline from the press? Like we have not seen a particularly toothy press corps when it comes to the Biden administration. I don't think that they have been particularly critical of them up till now. I don't see the problem that they are correcting for, except for please don't quote a House Republican unless the next sentence is who is lying or there is no direct evidence for.
Yeah, they use that word lie over and over again in their letter, which also I think it's weird that the letter got leaked because they didn't actually send the letter yet. So someone also is on your side being like, okay, this is crazy. Yeah, we got it before CNN and Fox and all of them did. So
yeah, well, this was reported by CNN. So
do you remember at the beginning of the Trump administration when Kayleigh McEnany was not yet the press secretary, but she was a talking head on behalf of Trump, and Trump was floating the idea of there being an official White House TV channel?
Yes.
That they would run, and everybody flipped the fuck out because that sounded like agitprop and, you know, government run media. Right. Yes, you were right the first time, gang. And so just indirectly doing it, same thing.
Yeah, I guess this is just the kind of malignant end of the quote unquote fact check culture of which is, you know, has become so politically captured that
this is why America needs to return to the lawful neutral character in the D&D fact sheet thing, right?
Yes.
Of I am applying the rules qua rules, because I think what's increasingly happened, and it's always been this way, but I think we're kind of reaching a fever pitch in politics of rules exist to restrain the bad guy. We're not the bad guys, so the rules don't apply to us. We're the good guys, right?
Yes.
So we can do this. It doesn't matter. We're the good guys, goddammit. It's for the bad guy. You're the bad guys. How do you not fucking understand this? You're the bad guys. We're the good guys. The rules apply to you. And it happens all the time. It's whoever's in power. And yet another example.
It is not at all shocking that you would like for America to be lawful neutral like you. Mm-hmm. That mm-hmm. We all yep. see ourselves in our institutions on some level, and you're like, please, more lawful neutral.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep.
From Austin, Texas, I'm Justin Robert Young. Oh, wait, I didn't know. Brandy, where are you?
I'm in Flathead Lake, Montana.
Okay. From Austin, Texas, I'm Justin Robert Young. From Flathead Lake, Montana,
I'm Jen Briney.
And from New York City,
I'm Andrew Heaton.
Get a rope. And we're not wrong on this edition of the program. We are going to talk about unions, the union gap between enthusiasm and membership, as well as the sentencing of Enrique Tarrio, the Proud Boy former chairman who got 22 years for January 6th. All that and your emails. Heaton, you've been shooting stuff up in New York, huh?
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. So we had already shot the pilot for this show I've been working on a few months ago, but we wanted to do for the desk piece, that is to say, guy in suit telling jokes about news. We wanted to do something more newsy. So we're reshooting that part. And while I was in town, we did a writers meeting where we got a bunch of writers together to pitch sketch ideas. Lots of really good sketch ideas came out of that. It was a lot of fun. It was like writer's rooms are great. You're dicking around with other comedy people, and then somebody takes notes, and then you go, whoop, we're all brilliant. Time for lunch. It's a lot of fun.
That sounds awesome. And you're returning back to Texas. So the next show, you'll be
Austin,
down
Texas.
Here.
By the time people hear this, I will probably be at the airport or have landed in Austin, Texas.
Oh, baby. Very exciting. We're just waiting for one Briney to reunite the trio.
The lease is signed and the U-Haul is ordered. So it's happening.
Well, let's go ahead and get into our top story here. In the midst of notable strikes and potential strikes unfolding this summer, the labor movement seems to be gaining momentum in the United States. At least if you pay attention to social media. Hell, even regular media has taken an above average interest in the WGA and SAG-AFTRA strikes in particular. But over the past 10 years, the American populace has consistently indicated growing approval for unions in surveys. So you'll have to take the word on this, Jen, since polls aren't real. However, the apparent surge in labor movements and proclaimed fervor contrasts starkly with the actual state of the union of membership, which has been in continual decline for the past 40 years, dwindling by about 50% from 1983 to 2022. Union membership encompasses only 10.1% of the workforce. This, as the United Auto Workers Union, one of the biggest, is poised to possibly strike at the end of this week. It raises a critical question. What extent of influence does the contemporary worker actually possess? And so we begin with you, Jen. Is the surge of union support simply progressive cosplay, or are we on the verge of a new organized labor revolution, which can only go up from here?
Well, I mean, I think it's real. I think that there's plenty of workers that realize that we have power in numbers, but the creation of the unions is a problem. Because I know I certainly wouldn't know how to go about it. I know that Starbucks workers have been trying to unionize, and here and there they've been able to do it, but as a whole, they're not unionized. Amazon workers have tried to unionize, and Amazon really targeted those that were in charge of organizing the signatures in the elections. I think there's an old union structure that I don't know who put it together, but our generation hasn't figured out how to use it to create unions for today. So while I think that there is an appetite for it, because I mean, we can all see the stats that productivity has gone up over the course of our lifetimes, but the wages haven't. Like, the workers definitely need to band together to fight the corporate powers. I mean, I think those are real feelings. I don't know the pathway to getting it done. And I think a lot of other people that are being paid minimum wage-ish jobs don't know either. And also seeing the reprisals against people that are in these companies and are trying to form the unions, that doesn't encourage people to be the person that takes charge and collects the signatures and does whatever you need to do to start the union. So I am hopeful that we have some kind of worker revolution going on, but what it's going to look like, I just don't think it's going to look the same as it did the first time around. I think that our generation is going to have to find a different way to form them, because the old way is proving to be pretty hard.
What do you mean by the old way?
Oh, well, that's the thing. I don't even know. Because, I mean, I was born in the early 1980s, and over the course of my entire lifetime, I've been watching unions be dismantled. I haven't seen really any new ones be formed. So I don't even know what it looks like to form a union. And so I think that's part of the problem, that someone my age, I'm in my 40s, like, there is no roadmap that I've seen, like a path to follow to create these things. So I don't know how the unions were formed, because in the 1980s, Ronald Reagan was breaking them up. And there was an entire movement saying that everything that was wrong in commerce had to do with the union. So I think to go in the other direction, we don't even know what that looks like. And that's why I think it's going to have to be a different path, because we're going to have to form our own, because I literally don't even know how they did it.
Heaton?
A few years ago, I was working in the House, and a Texan billionaire named T. Boone Pickens.
I love came his name.
I think you actually would have enjoyed him. He was a colorful character and very much agitating for wind power, incidentally. He came, and he was, I think at the time, agitating for subsidies for natural gas or something. I don't remember what it explicitly was, but he was addressing a bunch of people. I was in the room for this, on some energy policy that he wanted. And I raised my hand and I said, Mr. Pickens, as an environmentalist, I'm worried about your proposal. And very kindly, without snark, he just went, yeah, in my experience, everybody's an environmentalist till you ask them to pay $200 to help the environment. And then he just kept moving on. And I've never forgotten that. And I'm glad he told me that, because I actually fucking put my money where my mouth is. And I am inclined to look at any situation where there's a gap between real numbers and rhetoric as that kind of phenomenon. I think if you really want to see what people care about, you don't look at polling. Jen's right about this. You look at their checkbook. That's the thing you want to look at in terms of what people actually care about. And so I'm not going to put you guys on the spot, but for anybody that's very like pro-union, that's very pro-worker, my first question for them would be, how much money have you given to the AFL-CIO? And if the answer is zero, then I would go, yeah, everybody's in favor of unions until you're asked to pay union dues. So I don't think that this is something that's going to herald a big change. When I look at the numbers, and for the record, I'm not against unions. I understand the idea of collective bargaining against a corporate outfit. I do want the unions to be, I want the role of the government to be that of a neutral referee between unions and employers, which I guess makes me less pro-union than, you know, Buttigieg or Sanders or something like that. But I don't want to like make them go away. There are situations I've been in where I would have been in a union. But when I look at the numbers, the last few years, they keep declining. People don't actually seem to want to be in them. I don't know that they would be effective at this point, given that the nature of the economy has changed since their heyday. If you go back to the 50s, we were still living in a time period where manufacturing was a big part of the economy. Mm-hmm. And you also were very likely to have a job that you stayed in your entire life. You're going to go work on an assembly line at GM. You started working there at 18. You're going to top out at 60 and you're going to have a pension. You're a GM guy. Very few people are doing that now. Certainly not our generation. As Jen pointed out, we're all from the 80s. I've had like 19 different jobs. This is the longest one I've had in a long time, but most people aren't working in that one thing for a very long time. So I don't know that unions would be as helpful in that context. And why there's not an immediate gap, I think, is twofold between those numbers. It was in 1954, I think about one out of three American workers were in a union. Now, as you point out, it's about 10%. I think two things are going on there. They just don't seem to have as much efficacious with the average worker in terms of this is worth me putting my money into in order to get stuff out of it. I think that's happening. When you look at Bureau of Economic Affairs, that's a government agency that keeps track of these things. The percentage of labor's actually increased from the 50s. That is to say, within the profit margins of companies, labor, or not profit margin, within the overall income of companies, labor is a bigger proportion than it was in the 50s during the height of the union times. I suspect that the main reason that they've declined, and we're getting out of my expertise now, is that I believe under FDR, there were laws that were put in place that made it very easy to obligate people to join unions. And again, I'm shooting from the hip here, but I seem to recall that there was something put in place in the 40s where, like, you were either automatically in a union unless you voted against it, or if, you know, 30% decided to unionize, everybody had, I don't remember exactly what it was, but it was sort of at the time the law was tilted to be in favor of unions rather than neutral. I think that has been removed. And when it's just relying on getting people to join a union because they think it's a good idea to join a union, that number has not been very high.
Yeah, I think that unions kind of tend to stand in from a identity standpoint as a populist element, as a pro-worker, anti-boss thing, which I can understand why that's the hot topic version of this, I think, serious issue. But the reality of it, at least the argument that I see online, tends to be very South Park underpants gnome, where it's like, step one, form a union. Step two, step three, worker equality, labor utility. The real work of a union, of collective bargaining, at least the most successful ones that you've seen, yes, can be combative with the owners of their professions, but ultimately needs to be symbiotic. You need to work hand in hand with the owners to carve out better protections for your workforce, because you don't want to kill the golden goose. Where I think
that's the German model. The German model is much more convivial, much more labor and capitalist sit down at table kind of model. You also see, I think, a way better deployment of something approaching the minimum wage in Scandinavia, where rather than having a blanket minimum wage that applies to every industry and every locality, regardless of how much the locality is making on average and regardless of the profit margin of the industry, what they do is the unions negotiate with their employers for a minimum wage. So as opposed to the United States, where there's literally more economic discrepancy from the highest grossing county to the lowest grossing county than there is between the nations of Brazil and Britain, what they'll do is they'll go, okay, the grocer's union is going to talk to the grocer employer. They're going to work out what the minimum salary is going to be, because that is probably going to be different than what the minimum salary could be handled in a car manufacturing lot or something like that. So it is more convivial, where they're actually requiring to exchange information with one another in order to get to the best outcome for all parties.
Well, and that, I think, is, you know, the reality of the most productive unions, of whether or not the rhetoric gets hotter or you are saber rattling more amongst your populace, amongst your membership if you're a union. The stuff that you're fighting for is pretty simple X's and O's. You know, all right, we want to move the guaranteed pay to this. We want more sick days. We want more blah, 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 blah. Where it becomes its own pop culture thing is like what we're seeing with the WGA and SAG, where you have a lot of people that want to support a big, colorful fight. They don't really know what the negotiating committee is fighting for. They just know boss is bad, workers good, and these workers are better because they have symmetrical jaws and they're sexy people because they're actors. And so now we can fight for them and we can yell at Drew Barrymore and you know, just kind of identify along these lines. And that's what I find curious is, anybody who blanket supports unions to me is like somebody who blanket supports companies. There are good companies. There are bad companies. There are incompetent companies, in the same way that there are good unions. There are bad unions. There are incompetent unions. And when they are bad or incompetent, they do things like waste the benefits for which, or embezzle the benefits for which you have collectively bargained for. The existence of unions to me is not a panacea. It is the existence of competent unions, which is hard. That's 90% of the work, is having a productive and competent union. And I agree with you, Heaton. Part of the reason why we don't see them is because we have a lot of mobility in our workforce, to the point where we have all conscientiously opted out. We have all said, yeah, No, we're going to hang our own shingle.
Ultimately, I think that is the best protection workers have. The best protection workers have is to be able to tell their boss, fuck you, I'm going to another job. That's the best. The best protection is to have a bunch of options. That way I can leave if your option's bad and I'm forcing the options to compete for me. That's ultimately the thing that I think is best for people in terms of having a good workplace environment and a good salary, is if you've got enough competition that the workers are actively competing with each other to get the workers.
Well, and I'm wondering if unionization going forward, you know, we have these established ones like the Railroad Workers Union and the AFL-CIO, like we have the big ones. But I'm curious to see, because we did see these individual Starbucks locations unionizing their locations, or individual Amazon warehouses. Like, I am curious to see if it's going to be a less formalized process, and one where the people that work together, that see each other every day without collecting dues or any of that, are just going to kind of do informal unions and say, you give us this wage or we all walk. Because I do think the power of numbers over the bosses, I think that could work on a smaller scale. And I'm wondering if that's something we
that
might
see. That is strident anti-union talk. You're a union buster talking like that.
How so?
Because you are advocating for the idea that this could be worked out without a formalized union and a collective organizing strength amongst multiple warehouses or industries. That does not advance the union cause. The union is a organization that wants to gather as many people as possible with, to steel man the argument, the greater the amount of people, the more you can extract for the benefit of the workers. So the idea of saying, if we all just got together and said, we're going to walk out and you then get more money, that's a fantasy that doesn't actually happen, because you don't have a critical mass of people to do it. You need a union to do that. You need an organizing body to do that.
Are you saying you believe that, or that the unions believe that?
I'm saying that is the organizing principle of a union, and that anything south of that is the kind of stuff that's what Amazon's telling their employees. Why go pay union dues when you can just come into the boss's office all together and say what you want, and then we'll have a nice conversation? That's a fantasy. That's what the capitalist paymasters want you to believe, Jen.
I don't know. I think it could work. I mean, if you have one warehouse, you can't have an entire warehouse walk out on the same day. And if one warehouse is able to get a wage and the other warehouse hears about it, I mean, that could be a path to the larger unionizing effort. So what I'm seeing is that people are trying to figure out a way to recreate the unions. And like I said before, like, the path isn't clear, but it does seem to be happening on a smaller scale.
I do think it's fascinating that we have seen those kind of jobs push to unionize, because they're transient jobs by and large. People don't tend to spend their entire career working in an Amazon warehouse or at a Starbucks. But
also, Starbucks has benefits that would be the envy of many places that previously were unionizing. I mean, Starbucks, like, you get healthcare, I think, from the get-go. I don't think there might be a wait period before it kicks in, but I think it's fairly quick. And if you're there for like 3 years, they pay for your college. Like, there's some significant benefits that come from Starbucks,
whatever,
for being a fairly transient job. Huh?
Corporate bootlicker.
I'm the only Ted Steyer fan in the room. But I think Ted Steyer looked out for his employees. I think he deserves credit for it. Howard Schultz.
Tom Steyer was the environmental billionaire who.
Oh, that's right. We covered them on the same show previously on the Political Orphanage. But Howard Schultz, yeah. No, I think I think Starbucks actually has a lot of benefits. So I would be surprised if you'd be able to animate what is largely going to be a transient phenomenon and already has lots of benefits. That strikes me as an unlikely situation.
You know, just because you have benefits that are better than the worst doesn't mean they're good for the people that are actually having to live off of those wages, or the people that have already been to college and are working at Starbucks and that benefit doesn't do shit for them, or the healthcare. Like, sure, they get healthcare, but the deductible might be $12,000. Like, we don't know what their benefits actually are. And if they say it's not enough for them to have a comfortable life, I think that's what really matters. And I think that if they're choosing to try to unionize, that probably says something.
Okay.
So we don't think that it might just be because people are bored and they read a lot of things online about how unions are super cool and they want to be part of the super cool club.
I have never heard about unions being super cool. I don't know where you're getting that from.
They're super cool now. Again, people are really into it, according to surveys.
I think people are looking at their paychecks and wanting them to be bigger. I mean, I think the effort that it takes to unionize, I don't think you go through that. Or try, like, it is an adversarial thing to your boss. I don't think you go through that unless there's a real reason.
I think part of the antipathy to unions at this moment, again, like, I'm a very free enterprise guy and I'm like, unions make sense to me. It totally makes sense that you would want to have collective bargaining because the employer has more power than the aggregate employees. Makes sense. I would join it in many situations. Right. But a lot of the time, the energy that goes into the union efforts from where I'm at is not in the actual union versus boss phenomenon. It's in union lobbying government to help unions. And then I start to go, well, now I'm not that enthused about it. Like, during the last presidential election, Sanders, Warren, Buttigieg were all kind of coming out to try and come out with who was more pro-union in terms of federal law, not in terms of just like, yes, go unions against the employers, but like, let's ban at-will contracts. Yeah. You can't dismiss anybody. Let's make it illegal for firms to hire anybody if their unions are on strike. I would join people maybe in saying like, you can't forbid someone from joining a union. I think that in certain states right now, that is a law where if a company says, no, we just don't hire union people. Okay. Maybe we could like push it a little bit, but going to the point of like, nope, if somebody goes on strike, you just can't ever hire anybody. Then it's like, well, now the unions are operating as lobbyists for the government to not be a referee. And then I, the guy that was previously amenable to all of this, go, well, I'm out.
Yeah. And to your point, Jen, if you create a union, you've only begun the hard work. It is, you are now starting a company within the company that is representing the people. That's a lot of pressure. It's a lot of hard work, and the dues that you collect need to be spent judiciously. People can't agree on a lot of different things. And so I don't know. That's the one thing about the solidarity forever. Let's start a union for every company crowd that gets me is that it strikes me as people who are not particularly serious about the actual job of collective bargaining and utilizing that power. Cause you are only beginning another pathway of negotiation and politicking amongst your people. That I don't know is difficult. And again, it's like, it's easy to fritter away this money to lose the benefits. I mean, you see this stuff all the time where either through incompetence or greed, people wind up raiding, their pensions and stuff like that. And now all of a sudden all that money is just gone. It is hard work. And I support unions that do it well. But thinking that just creating another organization is going to solve all your problems usually ends in heartbreak, in my opinion. Patreon.com/WhereNotWrong is where you need to go if you want to support this program. Let's go ahead and take a look here. We are in the home stretch for our race to 1,000 patrons. Yes, We are only 43 away, 43 patrons away before we hit that magic number. Will it be you? Will you be among those 43? Head on over there and you get something for your money at any level. We will give you a bonus podcast where we do another topic, two topics normally on the show, three for you. And they often are wide ranging ones. This one's definitely going to be wide ranging because I don't know how long we're going to go on the topic that we chose in our group chat. But Politico got the 2024 Republican primary candidates and Cornel West, bafflingly, to give a playlist of songs that stirred their soul. That was
this changes my whole lineup. One of the people that I previously liked, I was like, "You soulless lizard person." And one of the people that I was very dismissive of, I was like, "God damn it, I like his music tastes."
Oh, I wonder. I wonder if we have the same, because there was one guy who I have been entirely dismissive of that I'm like, "Well, at least he has a good taste in music."
Yeah,
we will debate. We will discuss. We will have frivolity and fun on the Patreon episode. Patreon.com/We're Not Wrong. 43 more. Come on. Come on. I got a feeling as soon as we get around 20, there's going to be a rush. Because I think there's a bunch of people that are just waiting because they want to be the 1,000th. That's what tends to happen with this kind of stuff. Let's talk about the Proud Boys. In a significant ruling related to the January 6th Capitol attack, former Proud Boy chairman Enrique Terrio was sentenced to a record 22 years in prison by District Judge Timothy Kelly for orchestrating a seditious conspiracy aimed at impeding the peaceful transfer of power from Donald Trump to Joe Biden. Despite not being present during the attack, Terrio was found to have had substantial influence on the day's violent events, a stance reinforced by the prosecution, which highlighted his central role in plotting and encouraging the insurrection. Although the defense depicted him as a misguided patriot, his lack of remorse and substantial role in creating a command structure within the Proud Boys that contributed significantly to the violence observed on that day underscored the gravity of his actions. This sentencing comes as part of a series of convictions related to the attack, with several other Proud Boy members receiving substantial prison sentences. The defense has indicated that it intends to appeal, contesting the judge's perception and sentencing of Terrio. We've had a lot of conversations about January 6th. Indeed, I think it might be our most common recurring topic. We did a version of this podcast on January 6th. Should somebody who was not on the ground during January 6th be sentenced to 22 years in prison? We begin with you, Mr. Heat.
We're talking specifically here about Enrique Terrio.
Terrio, yes.
Terrio. I would have sentenced him to prison. I think 22 years was excessive, and I'll get to that in a moment. Overall, I think that the prosecution for the January 6th riots was pretty good in that most of the people that were in there, I think, probably should have been given a slap on a wrist. And what I mean by that is people that are coming in the back that don't fully know what's going on, that think they're part of a protest, they're innocent until proven guilty. The burden of proof is on the prosecutors. And so the majority of people that were involved in that, the majority of people that were prosecuted, I should say, since I don't think they went over everybody, but the majority of the people that were prosecuted were given like 2 years probation, a fine, some stuff like that, maybe a tad bit of jail time. But it wasn't like the state came down and tried to ruin the life of every person that was involved. And I think that was probably the discretion that should have been called for. With the leader of the Proud Boys, the fact that two things, one that weirdly, I'm going to like clarify something for the Proud Boys that isn't said very often. They're frequently purported to be a white supremacist organization. And it is worth pointing out that the head of their organization until he was incarcerated recently is a Afro-Cuban fellow.
That would be Enrique Terrio. Yes.
Enrique Terrio, which would militate somewhat against it being a white supremacist organization. He was not at the Capitol that day. He was not in Washington, D.C. that day. The reason is that he'd already been jailed or at least caught and dealt with by authorities because he and other Proud Boys had ripped a banner down that said Black Lives Matter from a Black Methodist church and set it on fire while, I think, lugging ammunition around Washington, D.C. And so he had been ordered to vacate Washington, D.C. He'd taken up residence in a hotel in Baltimore and was directing all of this by phone, which is why I think he is still salient to the prosecution. I read the indictment earlier today. I've not been able to go through the case itself and you know, watch the footage or read the transcripts of it, but I did read the indictment. And I have a lot of sympathy for people that showed up to support President Trump, that walked into what they thought was a protest and turned out to be accidental members of a riot. And I think that that should be used with a light touch. The members of Proud Boys and Oath Keepers that are being prosecuted are not those people. They were very aware of what they were doing. They had like a WhatsApp group that they were messaging each other on, including things like everybody delete these messages because the government might prosecute us. Like that's in there that they were like, we got to delete these messages. One of them forgot to do it.
Yeah.
And they are actively talking about war, about rebellion, about revolt. And it would be tempting to say that that was a rhetorical flourish were it not for the fact that they were also literally planning to stage a violent event at the Capitol and are talking about it. At one point, one of the people is advising within this clique is advising them to take as many followers as possible and be on the National Mall because they'd be able to see from all angles. And Enrique, the fellow we're talking about specifically, immediately texts back from Washington, D.C., no, you need to go into the Capitol. Like he is actively, like at one point, there is a moment where one of the Oath Keepers Proud Boys guys is saying, we should do it out here. And he is directed
to go into the Capitol. Out there?
Hold a protest. Try to let the politicians know that this is our country and we're taking it back.
So we are not talking about murdering politicians or harming or bringing physical violence to people specifically. They are looking for an explosive visual protest.
Well, I would say at that point, one of the guys was agitating for that. I mean, we can kind of mince words on whether or not they were planning to be violent or not in the indictment. Well,
And by that, I mean specifically violent toward people. And not trespassing our property.
Yes. Yeah. There was lots of rhetoric of, you know, we're going to take the Capitol, fuck the politicians. You want to fuck with us, see what happens. This is a war. This is a revolt. We're taking it this is a revolution. This is like, yeah. There's lots of that kind of rhetoric, right? In terms of like, we're going to go kill Nancy Pelosi or we're going to kill Mike Pence. I saw nothing about that specifically. I don't think that the fact that there's not specificity there alleviates the fact that there is very clear intent to obstruct government operations, which is what they were prosecuted on. However, the bit that I have a problem with is that they weren't just prosecuted on sedition and insurrection and obstruction of government property and government operation, all of which I think were legal and rightly selected for prosecutorial discretion. The bit that I am bothered by is that the sentences were further compounded by giving them terrorist charges. And I think that expanded beyond the remit of the government. I don't think that they would qualify as terrorists by most definitions, unless our definition of terrorist is somebody that strikes me as kind of a terrorist. Terrorism in most instances, when you get into the basic terminology of it, is inflicting violence on civilians in order to try to maximize psychological damage for some political end, which was not what that they were doing. So that to me was the prosecutors going, fuck them. Let's make an example. Let's just say they're terrorists, which I think was grossly overstepping it. So I do think that they were put in too long. I think 22 years is too long because they were using statutes, or I should say abusing statutes. So I think that that should have been stricken from it. And then I'll add, and this gets kind of weird, but like I looked into this right before we started talking. Do you know how long Jefferson Davis was in prison for?
No.
2 years. And so like, which I would say Jefferson Davis, probably the biggest threat to the Union.
Yeah.
And so I do think that while they should have been prosecuted, and the defense that they essentially had, at least that I read, which was that these are misguided patriots who believed they were restoring the election, which I think is true. I think they did really think that Trump won and that they were restoring the election through armed revolt, in effect, doesn't mitigate against the fact that it's armed revolt. If I am convinced that you stole my house and I break into the house and I take your shit like that. Like you've broken the law regardless of intent. Yeah. But I think the extent to which the sentencing happened, I think the sentencing was excessive.
I think some might have a quibble about armed revolt, right? Because did they have guns on them?
No, at least they certainly weren't used. So no, yes. Okay. Obstructing government operations. I would say that it got violent.
Yes.
And seditious and many other things there. Right. So I do think that the overall prosecution was correct, but I think the government was excessive to the point that we civilians should be a little alarmed that they were putting terrorism charges on them and that the sentencing was broadly correct, but excessive.
Jen, from the very beginning of the January 6th process, I don't know anybody else on earth that has kept more in touch with the various hearings and fact findings of not only the day itself, but also the conspiracy that led up to it in the January 6th hearings. What is your read on 22 years for Enrique Tarrio?
So when I'm about to say this, I'm talking about Tarrio in particular, the other Proud Boys people, which they were all indicted together. I think there's a difference between the different players. So I'm talking about just this guy who was branded as the leader of the Proud Boys and given 22 years. And I also read through the indictment, and I'm not only deeply disturbed by the 22 years, but by the indictment in general, for him in particular, because what I'm seeing is that this Tarrio guy created a new national Proud Boys chapter, which they called the Ministry of Self-Defense in December 2020, but it was a group chat. Like at the end of the day, they can call it whatever they want, but it was a group chat with like 6 to 8 people in it. What they specifically did, according to the indictment, is that they encouraged attendance at the January 6th rally. And in part of that, they used the internet to fundraise. Their fundraising was used to bring people out to the rally, which I've participated in rallies in Washington, D.C., and groups absolutely had fundraisers. They had buses bringing people to the rallies. Like, this is something that happens routinely. And this particular group, they did use that money to buy paramilitary gear, but the gear that they bought were vests and radios. They didn't buy a bunch of guns. And I think that if you are trying to show intent beforehand that they intended to storm the Capitol and take the building, they probably would have brought some weapons. So that for me felt like something that defended these people. The indictment also says that them dressing incognito was somehow evidence of something because they were not wearing their usual yellow and black or whatever.
Black and yellow. I think it's Perry Ellis polos.
Yeah. And I don't see how dressing like plants in the middle of a city is really evidence of anything. Then they're accused of leading the crowd to the Capitol. But again, Tarrio wasn't there. And I think the strongest evidence that they seem to have is that someone else in a voice memo in their group chat the day before Tarrio was arrested for the Black Lives Matter flag thing,
someone else said
that they wanted to base their operations, quote, around the front entrance to the Capitol building, unquote. Then a day or two later, after he gets out of jail or whatever, Tarrio responded, said he just heard the voice memo and said, quote, you want to storm the Capitol, unquote. But to me, that sounded like a clarification, not an order to do it. And then the guy's like arrested. So, and then the whole thing about deleting the messages, it wasn't like they were having these conversations and going, oh, we're doing something illegal, so let's delete the messages. They had that conversation the day after Tarrio was arrested. And then they said, let's delete the messages. So, and then I look at during the riot and the Tarrio guy, he did post, don't fucking leave. And then later he said he was proud of his boys. But that's First Amendment. He's not controlling anyone. I highly doubt that if he had said everybody leave, that it would have stopped.
That they would have.
Yeah. Like, so I'm seeing a guy who's not even there being accused of being on a group chat and saying, I mean, first of all, he called the Proud Boys a bunch of losers who like to drink. And so it sounds like he got in trouble for a lot of elevated rhetoric, definitely inflated egos with these guys. But the fact that beforehand, they didn't raise money to buy guns. They didn't bring guns. I just don't know if Theriault expected these people, because it sounded to me like they were planning a protest at the Capitol, either in conjunction with the rally or during the rally, but it sounded like they were planning a protest in front of the Capitol. And then when things went crazy day of, he was happy about it. But I did not see pre-planning of an armed insurrection. And I am deeply disturbed by 22 years for what essentially comes down to a group chat. Like, it's, I'm not okay with this. Like, I've said from the very beginning that the people that participated in the riot were deceived, and the people that were violent that day deserve to be punished for hurting police officers, breaking into the building, stopping the proceedings. Theriault is not one of those people. So, and he also said that he thought the election was stolen, and then he turned to the news and was told at every turn that he was right. So he's another one of these people that's been deceived. And at the end of the day, I still think that the responsibility for all of it lays with then President Donald J. Trump. So yeah, I think this is entirely too harsh a sentence. And I think he has a very good chance on appeal of having that reduced.
Would you have prosecuted him or the other people that were in this indictment at all?
The other people, yes, because the other people that were in this indictment were physically there when they went to the Capitol. They broke through the barriers. They went in the building. Like, they are a different case. But this guy, having not been there and just having been on the group chat and participated in the fundraising and all of that, like, I just don't see how he can possibly be responsible for what happened, which could have been a spur of the moment thing, even for the Proud Boys. Like, yes, they were excited and they participated, but I'm not sure that they intended to go into the building that day from what I saw in this indictment. Certainly not Theriault. Like I said, the other people were physically there. This guy was not. So that's why I say, like, I'm not talking about the Proud Boys as a whole, but this Theriault guy, like, all I saw is that they were talking about going to the Capitol. I didn't actually see plans to go in.
So first of all, truly, Jen, I applaud your consistency, and I applaud your skepticism of government narratives and prosecution in general. I think that your heart is very much in the right place. With Theriault, is there not some culpability for omission at that point? If he's the leader of the self-described Ministry of Self-Defense, and he is to some extent coordinating, and he's definitely in contact with them on the day of January 6th. He's definitely messaging back and forth because they're sending updates to this group chat and he's aware of it. And at no point he says, quit doing this. Like, they're telling him, we've seized SHIELD. This is crazy. This day's going to live in infamy. We've busted into the Capitol. They're giving him live updates as this is happening. It's not like he's watching TV going, this is nuts. He knows what's is happening. And he could have said, don't do this. And he didn't. It seems to me that he had both a coordinating role on the front side, and through having responsibility and leadership within this clique and not doing anything to stop it, is to some extent guilty of crimes of omission.
I mean, you could say the same for the president, but when it comes to planning ahead of time, I didn't see him planning the storming of the Capitol and stopping the actual proceeding. What I saw is he was coordinating as many people as possible to attend the rally. And so the pre-planning, no, I don't think that you should get in trouble for trying to get people to go to what was supposed to be a political protest. Even if they chose to change locations and protest in front of the Capitol, you're allowed to do that. So no, I don't think you should be prosecuted for that. And then day of, I mean, when you're talking about coordinating, being on a group chat with people that are participating in something, I don't think that gives you responsibility for what they do.
I'm in agreement with you in terms of the broad concepts here of absolutely nobody should be prosecuted for attending a protest, nor for mere rhetoric. But what I read in the indictment was that they were actively talking about revolution and overthrowing the government. These were things that they were actively discussing. They weren't saying, let's get a big show of people to show politicians how displeased we were. They were saying, we are going to go in and overturn the government and take the government back for the people. Like, that to me belies action. That belies willful steps to change the course of the election.
But those statements were not made before January 6th. Like, that inflated rhetoric about, like, we're doing this, like, that seemed to be happening on the day of. I didn't see anything before the actual day when they arrived in the Capitol where they were saying we're going to go into that building and stop the certification from happening. I just didn't see it. So yeah, they had the inflated.
I believe they had a plan that was outlined or a text thread called Revolution 1776, which was we're going to take key buildings and go from there. And they talk about like taking the house. So there was coordination. There was plan, and they were calling it a revolution.
So I'm glad you brought that up. That was something that was passed around that was not written by Theriault. So that I think matters to me, because if he's being branded as the leader of this, but that was not a plan that he put forward, I don't see how he can be held responsible for a plan he didn't write. So again, I'm only talking about Theriault here. The other guys, if they decided like this is their plan and then they acted on January 6th, I think they are a different case. Those are the guys that hit the police officers. Those are the guys that went into the building. They absolutely deserve to serve hard time for what they did. Again, it's not a plan he wrote. And he didn't participate on January 6th. So I just don't, I think he's being held responsible for the actions of others, even if he was cheering them on from afar. I just don't, 22 years for that, it seems extremely excessive.
We're in agreement that the sentencing is too long. As I said, I think calling them terrorist goes a step too far. I think that the prosecution overplayed its hand, partly to punish them because they didn't do a plea deal, which pissed off the government. The government doesn't like to actually prosecute, and partly because they wanted to make an example. So I don't disagree with you there. In terms of culpability as a leader, though, like if we were looking at this in a very, very different capacity, like let's say that the president of ExxonMobil is aware of plans that vice presidents are doing that are going to get people killed or be illegal. He didn't direct the plans, but he was aware of it and he didn't stop it. I would hold that guy culpable for that.
Well, hold on. Let's actually take the better analogy here, which is President Donald Trump. He was sitting there watching TV and didn't stop it. He's the leader of the entire thing. He's the leader of the entire country, for Christ's sake. And I think I've been pretty consistent in saying, unless he actively said, stand down, allow this to happen, him sitting there and doing nothing is not a crime. So Theriault doing nothing, I don't think that's a crime either.
Here's what has bothered me about some of this prosecution. And Heaton, I do agree with you. If that there should be legal culpability for walking into the house, there should be legal culpability for fighting with police, there should be legal culpability for disrupting a government function. I am sympathetic, based on stuff I've heard, some of which from Jen's program, that this was a clusterfuck organizationally by the Capitol Police, that there is a broken system for which to deal with something like this. And ironically, it was because of groups like the Proud Boys, who in previous DC protests, the problem that the Capitol Police had when it was a Trump or a conservative protest was not storming or defacing buildings. That tended to be more of a problem with Black Lives Matter or leftist protests, that they had more of a problem with people defacing buildings and doing stuff like that. With conservative protests, it was fighting in the streets. And because of groups like the Proud Boys, who would be very, very belligerent when it came to counter protesters and would often get into fights on the streets. And so the layout for how they had on January 6th was, as we have found out, very woefully inadequate when it came to protecting buildings, including the Capitol, and wound up with horrifying consequences. But when we start to use terms, not only rhetorically, but also legally, like terrorist and sedition and revolutionary, to me, it doesn't leave a lot of room for how we would describe somebody that, I don't know, actually had a predetermined plan to go into a building and seize it and murder people, that brought in guns, which even with the Oath Keepers, which brought guns to Washington, they left them in their hotel safe when they went down to the protest. Like, so they're if we're going to be realistic about what happened, I'm not saying that they should escape any and all judgment legally. I do believe that there should be some kind of reaction to it. But when we're describing them as if they were going in there trying to bring a bomb, trying to bring a weapon, trying to actually seize or hold the government hostage, I just don't think that matches the facts as I know them, at least.
You both make very good points. The counterfactual with the guns is a salient one. They certainly had access to arms if they'd wanted to use them. They didn't. Those were left behind, which would indicate that they were exercising restraint in whatever they were up to, or at least weren't willfully trying to seize the government by armed force and then overturn the election. You make good points, gang.
There we go. The good point police have backed us up, as you can hear with the sirens.
Can I say a couple other things though?
Sure. Go ahead.
Like this kind of like dovetails into the other stuff. To backtrack a little bit for what it's worth, just to touch base on a prior issue we talked about, with Trump getting prosecuted under RICO law in Georgia.
Yeah.
I now think that's a bad idea. And the reason that I think that that's a bad idea is that, saying that political campaigns can be criminal organizations, I think opens up the door for what will become inevitably and ultimately prosecuting the Republican Party or the Democratic Party as a whole. I think that if we start going down that route, that's probably going to happen. And I think the implications of that are interesting in this case. If we're going to apply RICO logic to the Proud Boys, then the leader of the Proud Boys would probably end up being part of it through culpability of competence. If we're not going to use RICO law, then I think your cases are more salient.
I think when it comes to like a group trying to do something, this group on a group chat, there were like 6 or 8 of them, which were coordinating going to Washington, D.C., is quite different from a group of people beyond a political campaign. The campaign was over. The election was over. This was a group of people that were coordinating in 7 states to fraudulently turn in documents saying that he won an election that he had lost. They involved dozens of people in this plot in order to get signatures on those documents to make them look real. This is a very different thing. Their intention actually was to give Donald Trump power that he did not win an election, where the intention of the Proud Boys people, I think it was to go to a rally and I don't even know what. That's the problem. Like, I can't tell what their intention was. Their intention, it's not clear enough for me to deserve 22 years that they intended to take over the Capitol until the opportunity seemed to just be laid in front of them by the incompetence of the Capitol Police. But the intention of what Donald Trump and John Eastman and Cheesebro and Giuliani, the intention of what they did was crystal clear. And they did it as a group. And I don't think it's about a political campaign, because this is after the election. So I think it's a very different thing. I don't think those comparisons are apt.
Well, let's also point out that this was not prosecuted under RICO law. The Proud Boys,
not prosecuted under RICO law. It's just the stuff in Georgia that's prosecuted under RICO law. None of the other Trump indictments are not the Proud Boys, not the Oath Keepers.
I am sure that we will continue to talk about the Georgia case for many weeks going forward. To me, Heaton, the troubling precedent beyond the RICO stuff, which we talked about when the charges came down, is the follow through on county level district attorneys running for office based on prosecuting political enemies as a campaign promise and then doing it. That I think is something that we have seen both with Alvin Bragg and with Fannie Willis. Regardless of what you think of those charges, I do think that that is something that is troubling, because the pendulum is going to swing the other way. And as we have already seen with the impeachment stuff, you know, this is uglier to have this jump in the middle of a political scene. But again, we will debate the efficacy of that trial, which will be televised, by the way, because Fulton County Woo-hoo! Trials are televised. So yes, the Monica Lewinsky trial meets the OJ trial in the middle of a presidential campaign. I'm glad we finally have returned to seriousness in our political reality. We're not wrong pod at gmail.com. Put a nickel in the machine and see what you get. We're not wrong pod at gmail.com. Teaching the debate right. It occurs to me that you guys take some liberties with the We're Not Wrong acronym. Some people use WNR while others use WNW. So let me ask this, because have you guys noticed that people sometimes will refer to We're Not Wrong as not WNW, but WNR?
I have never seen that, and it's certainly not something the three of us do.
No, it is not. But there is a group. There's a strain of our listenership that will religiously refer to the show as WNR.
That's disturbing.
So why did Nebraska fill a football stadium for women's volleyball? Writes, as a Husker through and through, we broke the women's attendance record because we love winning. Since the football team has been mid at best since 9/11, we fell in love with our national championship winning volleyball team. Winning is everything. Go Big Red. Which I was thrilled to hear, because you ever get the sense, and this is just because maybe I'm just, my brain is broken by way of the political cesspool that I just live in. But I, the second that I saw a gigantic football stadium filled in Nebraska for women's volleyball, I was just bracing for the Atlantic article of actually the football stadium of volleyball people were transphobes or something like that. I was just waiting for it to become an ugly culture war issue. I am very heartened that that has not happened. And indeed, it seems that the Cornhusker faithful just really like their women's volleyball team so much so that they filled a stadium for it. I am thrilled that it is just pure and simple college tribalism. I could not be more excited.
Yeah. And that I love it too, that they are supporting their women who are winning. Cause I've seen it in other schools where it's like the football team wins, but then a women's thing wins and like no one gives a shit. I love that the Nebraska people cared that much. So it's, the whole thing just made me happy.
Yeah. Ever since the option offense was revealed to be bullshit and the Nebraska football team fell apart.
Yeah. Big Ten.
You looked that up, didn't you?
No, that was, I've been learning from you guys. Was it relevant when me shouting out Big Ten to the Defy?
It was. I believe they're in the Big Ten. Yeah.
Yes, yeah. There we go. I got to say stuff too.
Will, I'm going to need tranquil background music for this. A poem for men with metal sticks in thunderstorms writes, bolts on the brink. And men on the links, her thumbs flew in all haste. Look to the black, not the green, ye hack. Return, no time to waste. Though missives plenty, she warns, the game will ne'er be delayed. Their metal sticks in thunderstorms call Zeus wrath that day. Flee, flee, the torrential swarm, Poseidon steps on nigh. You've metal sticks in thunderstorms, heed your wife's wise cry. 'Tis but a wee squall, men jape and they call. What need do we have for alarm? Alas, the horn, alas, the horn, the men they cried in vain. Our metal sticks in thunderstorms are called now to abstain.
So good.
Very nice. Very nice. That now I think replaces the charge of the light brigade in my favorite poems. Congratulations.
And by the way, this poem was like twice as long. I had to cut it down because I wasn't going to spend 15 minutes reading this epic poem that was written all about Jen trying to get her husband back from playing golf because a thunderstorm was coming in, which was in the intro. We have the best community, folks. You'll love to see it. The El Paso Perspective writes, you mentioned El Paso a couple times in the most recent episode, so I wanted to share my perspective as someone who grew up in El Paso. Growing up, I had teachers and babysitters and classmates and a housekeeper who would cross the border from Juarez to work and spend time with family. My friends would bring candy they brought from vendors who carried boxes of candy to sell on the bridge. UTEP is an excellent university, and many students lived in Mexico would cross the border every day for class. People living in El Paso would cross to eat excellent Mexican food with melty acerdo cheese that had not been approved for sale in the U.S. yet. People would buy their medications in Juarez or have minor surgeries or dental work done because it was less expensive. El Paso and Juarez are the same community. They just happen to have an arbitrary line drawn between them. And since Trump built his disgusting blight of a wall in our beautiful mountains, the lines at our bridges have gotten too long for daily crossing. This hurts the economy and community of both countries. I've never understood how special El Paso was until recent policies violated our city.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that. I had no idea because we went through El Paso and I saw the wall and just didn't think anything of it. I didn't realize it was new and that it tore your community apart. So thank you for telling us that.
That would actually be the most effective cosign of the fact that the wall is working, that it destroyed the community.
I guess. Hey,
I'm super in favor of immigration and I'm super in favor of porous borders. And I think that you can not only marry and have sex with whoever you want, you can also hire and do business with whoever you want. You can purchase shit from whoever you want. So I'm very, very pro freedom of movement. I do want to ask, and I say this only because I've heard Republicans bring it up, that there's a much higher amount of crime on the Juarez side than the El Paso side. And that were you to have a complete freedom of movement there, that would likely bleed over. And I don't know the answer to that. I'd be curious to your thoughts, although I very much like the idea of the pre-wall society that you're describing and the idea that the borders themselves would be fairly fluid.
Immigration Woes writes, just wanted to share that I wholeheartedly agree that the immigration process is a difficult struggle. I, an American citizen, married a woman from another country more than a decade ago. We've been living ever since in her home country. Recently, I had the opportunity to move back to the States and bring her with me. Even going through all the proper channels, this process is far from straightforward and highly stressful. The normal process for a marriage visa lends itself more toward ease on new relationships and not established marriages. And I'm struggling to prove insane levels of detail that are not readily transparent when you don't have an established U.S. background for the last decade. And even though we've been together for a substantial amount of time, we still have to prove positive intentions on her part. I'm going to add editorially that a friend of ours who married a woman from another country has, I think, 2 years they've been living in America, and they are just now getting her ability to work in America. Like that is a long and drawn out process, which adds yet another wrinkle to a very complicated immigration debate, because legally it's a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
I know multiple people who have lost relationships because of this. One of my dear friends from Oklahoma was in love with and in a relationship with a gal from, I think she was from South America, but they knew each other from Spain, and he wanted to bring her over to the United States, and they got married and ran afoul of some immigration agency paperwork or something. And it just, the whole thing stopped and they ended up splitting up because just over the course of 2 years of not being able to live together, they weren't able to do that. And as we talked about last week, this is one of those things where the executive branch does have a fair amount of discretion to make things worse. And that oftentimes happens. And it's a real shame. Like, you go back, like there are periods of American history that were, I'll say overall, I think America is still one of the most pro-immigrant countries, if not the most pro-immigrant country in the world in the history of mankind. But there are periods where we were even better. The late 1880s, something like a quarter of the U.S. population was first-generation immigrant.
But that was like, we had like 100 people here. So 25 people showed up.
A ton of people were showing up. Like the country was very much an immigrant country, and that corresponded with the biggest economic boom in American history, because a lot of this bullshit is the idea that foreigners are going to come take our jobs and that it's going to hurt things. And I think the historical record's quite the opposite, that is a net benefit, and that the vast majority of people are improved by it. And hey, man, like, I'm sorry you're going through that with your spouse, and I hope you come out okay on the other end. Also, if she's got a sister, I feel like green card marriage could be a good thing for old heat and depend.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Click writes, most of us are sick of talking heads on cable TV, and even comedians tackling politics has gotten very by the numbers. So how would you guys go about making We're Not Wrong the television show?
I don't know. Go to Justin's second living room. Where he's got it all set up for us already.
I know, right? I hope when everybody's here that we're going to at least do a couple episodes streamed live from my set. So at least be on YouTube. I don't know if it'd be a TV show.
I'm going to have to change out of my sweat jacket, but yes.
I know. You're actually going to have to look like a human being.
I know. I come to your house all the time in workout clothes and it's not a good look.
I know. Your permanent wardrobe is hungover sorority girl.
It's so true.
Hey, listener, I share your frustration. I'm in New York and I visited friends at a major television company yesterday and was reminded of how much I hate.
Why don't you want to say Fox News?
I don't know. I think like, I have some residual fear. But you know what? It was funny because like I was talking to one of my friends there that's still there who's doing very well. And he was like I could just see the pain in his face where he's like, yeah, it's been pretty venomous at like at it just. And then I got on the elevator and it was like President Biden said something uncomfortable on 9/11. Does he hate America? And it was just stupid, frivolous bullshit. Like not even like good conversations about deep issues. It was just dumb shit that could all at the bottom be blue team bad. Yes. Like it could all be that. And it was man, I'm glad to be out of that world. So anyway, yeah, we'll do the McLaughlin group in Justin's living room.
Yeah. You know, there's some real creaking in the hull of cable. There was a big fight with Charter and ESPN that resolved at kind of the 11th hour, but it had been the first time that any cable system had stood up against ESPN, which is the longest reign. They invented the model of carriage fees. There were rumors that Disney's going to discontinue the Disney Channel, that they just want everybody to be, so they're just going to give up the carriage fees, that it's not worth it to keep it running.
Straight to streaming. And
they'll just say, hey, go with streaming, but running the concept of running cable channels, becoming too expensive or a liability is something that is,
I think they're fucked. I was like yesterday before I went in, it always behooves you to make friends with the front desk security guards, friends and neighbors. Whenever you're going into any major media institution, make friends with the people at the front desk and make friends with the people that run the cafe. That's my advice to you.
Yeah.
And I was hanging out with the front desk security people. And I was like, hey man, like I used to work here. I don't recognize you. How long you been here? And he's like, oh, 5 months. And I was like, oh, cool. Like, and he's like, yeah, they're about to redo the whole building. They're going to drop $330 million into it. And I was like, that's a lot of fucking money for aesthetics. Like $330 million. That's a lot. I mean, that's a lot of play money to go into redoing a building that, granted, when I worked in it, I would describe the wallpaper color as suicide beige. And I'm not confident that any of the air had been circulated out of the building since the Carter administration. So like there were a couple of things, but overall it was fine, right? $330 million. And I was talking to one of my friends about it because I don't want to get him in trouble, so I won't give too many identifying things. And I like the guy, but I was like, dude, like
Sean Hannity.
It was Sean Hannity. I was like, I think you should have a lifeboat because like you're doing really well right now. But, you know, newspapers, the highest grossing year for newspapers was the year before they bottomed out. And I think cable television, like I was talking to him. I'm sure I brought it up on the show, but it's fresh in my mind. Right when I started working at Fox Business, like week one, we were doing a test shoot of the show. So I'm in the control room and they're just going through the motions to see what it looks like. And there was a VP of the company and I'm just chatting with him. And he's like, he's very much a production VP type guy. He's not an ideological VP type guy. He's just a TV news guy.
Whenever you've told this story, I just think of now, Kieran Culkin from Succession, dude in a suit. On his phone, you are just like a buzzing extra trying to make a small talk. And then this line comes spitting out.
I go, how long you been here? He's like, oh, 25 years. And I was like, well, what's something interesting that's changed? And his face drops and he goes, if they ever unbundle cable television, we're fucked. And I was like, okay. That's not what I asked about. And he just started going, HBO did it. If the other ones figure out how to do it, we're dead men. And I was like, okay. Interesting that you'd said that unbidden. And that's exactly what Justin's alluding to.
Well, it's even worse. It's the whole thing is falling apart. So it's not even just that they're, the cable platforms are saying you need to unbundle your stuff, because that's partly the reason why Fox Business exists, is that News Corp said, hey, if you want to if you want to carry any Fox stuff, including Fox Sports and Fox News, blah, 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 you got to carry everything, which means you got to carry Fox Sports 2 and you got to carry Fox Sports Business. And by the way, each one of those are going to be their own carriage fees. So you are using one thing to negotiate for all these things. And that's the bundle. The problem is that cow that these companies were milking very vigorously with a very heavy hand is now beginning to run dry. And now the systems are starting to say, no, we're not going to do all this crazy bullshit. And we're not going to pay for all these different channels. We are running out of money. We still have X amount of money. We're going to have everybody's parents and grandparents that are around our age that don't want to learn how the internet works until they die. But we're going to glide on that. And you need to get your ask in line.
Yeah, I'm actually really furious right now with the bundling that's happening with YouTube TV and the NFL, because Joe and I love watching Red Zone, which, Andrew, you probably don't know, but it's Big a channel 10. That...
Jesus Christ.
Oh, college. Yeah.
No, this
no,
is
wait,
pro
No, NFL.
Football.
National yeah. Forensics League.
Yeah. And on on Sundays, they play like all the games at the same time, especially in the morning. And so Red Zone will go to whatever game is about to score. And you can watch, like, sometimes it's just one game, but sometimes it's four games. It's the best. And you kind of just watch all of them at once. And back in the day, I used to be able to just get that channel. But what they did now is they made a deal with YouTube TV that in order to get that channel, I have to pay $75. Yep. $75 a month for YouTube TV with all the channels I don't want. Then I also have to have a Sunday ticket, which gives me all of the football games, which I'm not trying to watch. I just want Red Zone. And then I can get Red Zone on top of that. So to do this, I would probably be like at least $150 a month for this one channel that I want because of the bundling. And from my own behavior, Joe and I just decided like, okay, fuck it. We're not going to watch football that much this year. Like yeah. They're just not holding us hostage anymore. And I'm hoping that more people are going to make the same decision because it's a scam.
I did the same thing with snooker. I was like, why am I paying all this money just to watch snooker? Fuck you.
He's potting pinks all over the place. I am a happy customer of YouTube TV and the Sunday ticket. I am thrilled that they have it. Yes, I do.
Yes.
And I have Red Zone, and I've already promised my brother. I promised my brother that he will get one of my streams because apparently, unlike DirecTV, they are not super strict on two different IP addresses using it. So my brother is going to get one of them. Please, I don't know. That's probably illegal. Anyway.
well, either way, I'm coming to your house every Sunday.
Here's what I will say. It is an absolute travesty that they killed the wrong Red Zone. The DirecTV Red Zone. The DirecTV Red Zone used to be so much better. Shut up. It used to be so much better that they had an actual set. Andrew Siciliano would be there. He was my friend. This new dude, Hansen, who all the cable troglodytes have come to think is the Red Zone, isn't even on camera. We don't even know. Yeah. He just is a talking head.
Yeah,
so I've been stuck with him. Andrew, shut up. I've been stuck with Hansen forever, and he's getting better, but he's never as good as Andrew Siciliano. I don't understand why they don't just fire Hansen and put Siciliano on.
Even if you save the money on the set, whatever. I guess they didn't want to pay for the set. That's fine. I mean, God forbid you're not making enough money, you fucking animals. All right, whatever.
I know. I'm with
Big
you.
10.
I do like the idea of the merchandising opportunities of just in whatever heat and font, just Big 10 exclamation point for any time that sports is being talked about. Mr. September writes, as a 40-year-old public high school teacher of 15 years, I've seen the Playboy Bunny logo become nothing more than another flashy graphic. When I remark, nice porn shirt, these teenagers just give me a blank stare. It's a brand, they say. I reply with, a brand for what? And they shrug. No one seems bothered by it. The school administration doesn't have a problem with it either. So I guess it's really classy now, or maybe there's just so much depravity out there that Playboy is considered not worth the societal effort, or maybe it's just successful marketing. You know, I read a thing the other day that Nirvana is thought to just be a clothing brand now for Gen Z. They don't really know Nirvana, but Nirvana as a logo or the t-shirts, the iconography is still popular in a post Hot Topic world where these kids, 13-year-olds just walk into Hot Topics, right? And they just see the t-shirts that are there and they're like, oh, Nirvana, that looks cool. But they just think it's a clothing brand. They don't know it was a genre defining band.
We're so old.
Ancient.
See, I think and hope what's going to, I think I become ironically hip in my 50s. I think it definitely didn't happen in my 20s or 30s. So I think maybe in my 50s, I'll become a cute old guy. And then I'll catch the back end of one of these movements. And I'll be like, I also don't know what that band is. And people will go, Big Ten, and give me a big high five.
Can't wait for our first live show. Just the Big Ten chants happening. They're rippling throughout the audience. How to get a reply. Heaton to reply writes, number one, happen upon a picture that looks like him in a children's book. Number two, write a detailed story about him and explaining the existence of the picture, including references to the to economics, falconry, male modeling, tariffs, and or zoning. And step three, send the picture with along with the story with him via email. He will be sure to reply. So if anybody wants Andrew Heaton to reply to them, please follow these three simple steps.
That's what my dad does, and it works.
We're Not Wrong is a production of Dog and Pony Show Audio. Our editor is the great Will Saddleberg, still reeling from that punt return on Monday night, assuredly. Jen, what's happening on Congressional Dish?
So, I'm in the middle of my episode cycle, but I actually want to tell you guys about something I did on my Patreon feed for Congressional Dish, which is that I didn't ask me anything about the digital nomad lifestyle. And Joe and I recorded the episode together. It's 2 hours of answering all the questions that were submitted about how we do this, how we live in hotels, how we work, how we travel with the dog. Tons of stuff in there. So if you're curious, support Congressional Dish at whatever amount you think is fair per episode, and you can get that. Ask me anything about digital nomad life.
Nice. Heaton, the ORF.
The whole thing this week is a rant about how Hanson is really not holding a candle to Andrew Schepitelli, who's my favorite sports
Schepitelli?
Broadcaster.
Schepitelli?
Great American Schepitelli. No,
he got the S right.
I know.
I have a fun thing.
I have another S word for him.
And I would not normally kick it to a host in particular, Jen. I think you'd actually really enjoy the show this week if you have time and you wanted to. I encountered a guy a few months ago that blew my mind. A lot of the fights we have in politics and political economy are between the private sector and the state. A lot of the arguments that Jen and I have are between the private sector and the state. The guy that I brought on the Political Orphanage this week, named Guy Standing, posits that we ought to think of the domains as the state, the private sector, and the commons. And according to him, the commons is something that is distinct from the state, and that's part of the problem with everything we're arguing about. I don't agree with him in to the extent that he takes it, but it was a really interesting thing, and I always welcome opportunities to think differently and approach things differently. And so it's a very interesting episode about how we would approach governance if there's a difference between things like sovereign wealth funds and the Bureau of Land Management, if we start to think of that as different than just the state. So that's on the Political Orphanage.
On PX3 this week, oh, I'll tell you what, the Friday episode is going to be a really, really good one. The Washington Post this week reported on presidential candidate Tim Scott's relationship status. He is, unlike everybody else in this race, unmarried, no kids. He is a devout man of faith that at one point was preaching adult abstinence and waiting till marriage. According to the Post, he is now, he says that he was not as able to wait as he was preaching earlier in his life, but he says he has a girlfriend. The girlfriend was not made available to the Washington Post, but the author of the piece seems to think that nobody would be so stupid to reverse catfish America while they're running for president. He says it is for her privacy. It has led to a lot of my girlfriend lives in Canada and she goes to another school. You'd never know her jokes. But I go through the rise of the non-traditional wife and kids politician with Kamala Harris and Tim Scott as the two examples, while looking through the history of how we look at the traditional expectations for marital status and kid having in the highest levels of politics. So that's going to be on our Friday PX3 episode.
I knew nothing about Kamala. How is she unconventional?
She doesn't have kids. A female politician without kids, very rare. And it was thought to be a liability for her as she began to go national. But
it turned out her personality and policy positions were really the big big liabilities that she faces.
Well, we will see.
Like, I didn't know that either. Oh, she didn't have kids. Not surprising.
That wasn't on my radar. And during the 2020 primary, I was talking to Tamar, my a friend of mine who worked on PX3 for a while. And I was like, oh, what do you think of Kamala Harris? And she's like, doesn't have kids. Women don't trust her. And I was like, oh, really? And it was a perspective for which I did not have.
She's polling below Biden right now amongst Democrats and Republicans. Like, think about that for a minute. It's like we have historically unpopular candidates and the VP candidate is polling below Biden with all the concerns people have in the Democratic and Republican parties about the competency of Biden. He's still outperforming Kamala Harris.
But no one liked her. That's why she wasn't the presidential candidate. So I don't think that's surprising.
Yeah.
I also think part of that is by design. You don't give your vice president anything to do by choice because you don't want to be outshone. There is, as you know, the Big Ten crowd will know, there is the old adage, there's no one more popular in town than the backup quarterback. And so you intentionally want...
said it best.
Schwitzer, Jesus Christ. He was from Oklahoma, too.
Yeah.
All right.
So I know about him.
For Andrew Eaton, shut up. For Andrew Eaton, for Jen Briney, I'm Justin Robert Young. We're not wrong.
Dog and Pony Show Audio.
Shithead.
I was feeling bad about telling you to shut up, and then Justin did it too, and now I'm really
fine. Sports fans are a persecuted minority. We're the new nerds.
Real quick, Barry Switzer, this is why I like him.
What he Barry brought Switzer a gun do, onto an airplane once. He was an active drunk.
Oh, I hadn't heard the bit about the gun. The active drunk I find endearing.
Yeah.
What he would do is he would, when he was trying to recruit, I think I told, Justin, I know you and I've talked about this. Jen, I don't know if you heard this story, but when he was trying to recruit football students and like there was a hard sell, he'd root through the dumpster behind their house. Like he'd go through the trash to find what beer they had. And then when he went in to meet the parents the following day, they're like, when you get you anything, you'd be like, probably not. I mean, these days I really just drink Milwaukee's Best. You can't get it anywhere. And they're like, well, actually we have, would you like a Milwaukee's Best? Oh my God. I'd love a Milwaukee's. Are you a Milwaukee's Best man? My God. Best. No, I love that beer. Yeah. He was, I'm really surprised he didn't do better in politics given his personality type. He ran for lieutenant governor. He didn't get it. I think he would have been fun.
Barry Switzer. Is a character, a football character of all time. But there's a great book written by Jeff Perlman about the Cowboys teams of the 90s, which were an absolute fucking nightmare. Like they were out of control. They bought a house together that they called the White House just so they could cheat on their wives and fuck each other's girlfriends in a central Whoa. Location. They turned a quaint team tradition where they would go to various different towns around the Dallas area and Texas in general. And then the Cowboys would play against the local fire department or something like that. And normally that they would let the fire department win and everyone would cheer and it would be a fun thing.
They just fucked them up. Did they fuck them
up? They got alpha, like intense about it. It would just blow out the local fire department. They would take the team plane to it. So they'd land in a private jet in these small Texas towns, beat the living shit out of the like fire department or the police, and then get on and continue cheating on their wives, including the owner. But
this is the best pitch for football I've ever eventually heard in my life. This is like I am finally slightly interested in the sport through the last 45 seconds.
Jimmy Johnson was the head coach at that time as they became this dynasty, and they would just win at all times. They almost lost against the Pittsburgh Steelers in Super Bowl 30. And the reason was they'd been to so many Super Bowls. They were more concerned about organizing the wives, girlfriends, and mistresses in a limo train from Dallas to Arizona, where the game was being taken place, that was more on their minds than the actual game. That being said, at the height of their debauchery, the owner has a fight with their coach, Jimmy Johnson. Jimmy Johnson leaves, goes to TV, and they replace him with legendary out of control alcoholic Barry Switzer. And the team only goes more insane. I believe that they won that Super Bowl under Barry Switzer, the one I just talked about. But yeah, intense times.
I didn't know about any of this. And I just find it fascinating that it's the Cowboys, yes, which has a hole in their stadium so that God can watch his Cowboys.
Yes.
So pious, this group of people.
The book begins with Michael Irvin, a star receiver, being so mad that a lineman had taken his turn to get his hair cut during training camp. They had one barber, that Michael Irvin starts screaming, "Seniority, seniority, seniority," before picking up the shears and stabbing the lineman in the neck.
Stop.
That's how the book begins. It's fucking great. I think it's Boys.
What book is this?
Boys Will Be Boys, I believe, is the name of the book. But Jeff Perlman, who wrote a great book about the Mets, and actually is the source material for the Winning Time HBO series about the Lakers. That's his book that they optioned to make the series. But yeah. So yeah. Okay. Anyway, we'll put this in at the end of the main show.